Welcome to Communicating Care, a podcast of the Just Transition Collaborative at the University of Colorado Boulder, where we talk about the ways environmental and climate justice advocacy are motivated by, express, and foster care. On this podcast, we listen more deeply to people who've made headlines for making a difference, to learn from their insights for successful creative climate communication and behavior change. I'm the host, Professor Phaedra Pezzullo, and today our guest is Dr. Stacy Alimo, a professor of English and core faculty member of environmental studies at the University of Oregon. She is the author of three books and multiple co-edited volumes and essays. She also is the co-editor of a new book series, Elements, for Duke University Press. Globally recognized as a leading scholar on gender, sexuality, and the environment, I am excited to talk with her about her research on plastics, gender, and ocean life. Thank you for joining me today, Stacy.
Thank you, and I'm really happy to be here with you.
To begin, you're an award-winning teacher and graduate mentor. Can you share a bit about one or more formal and informal teachers that have shaped your academic life?
You know, it's funny, that question makes me think of being in graduate school and going out with all my graduate school friends every Friday, and people were so excited about new ideas and about teaching and about, you know, whether pedagogy can affect politics and just all that energy and enthusiasm about the potential for the humanities and thought and creation to work in the classroom in positive ways. And yeah, I remember that. And then in my last job, I had so many colleagues who were incredible teachers, and I'll have to point out Ken Romer as one of them from University of Texas at Arlington. His dedication to teaching and mentoring in Native American studies and literature, and mentoring the students from the Native American Student Association. And then my friend Penny Ingram, who was just brilliant and passionate and absolutely fierce in her teaching of gender and race and critical theory. So just really the people who I've always worked with around me, and their dedication to teaching has been inspiring.
I love that. We both became vegetarians at an early age. I believe you were 13. What joys do you find in eating and immersing yourself in a plant-based diet as a way of life?
So I think the food itself is so joyful. I mean, actually the colors and textures and tastes of all the vegetables and fruits. And then, of course, the knowledge that I'm minimizing my complicity in the horror of and cruelty of factory farming, and also the environmental effects of factory farming. And then the delights of gardening. So in Eugene, Oregon, I'm really lucky because I have strawberries, blueberries, vegetables, all of this in my backyard. And I feel very utopian going out there and in the morning, in the summer, eating like blueberries right off the vine or the bush. But then again, I also have to acknowledge that my house is on Kalapuya land. And as a settler colonialist, there is no innocent way to experience the pleasures of this place. So it's always that kind of both and, you know, like the beauties of what I'm eating out of my garden, and then also this sense that I really shouldn't be on this land to begin with. It's all there.
Mm-hmm. That's one of the reasons I always enjoy your work and engaging you, because I find you embrace joy, but not in a naive way, but in a what I would call a realist way.
Thank you.
You also grew up in the state of Michigan, which does not border an ocean, but I think it's fair to say you love oceans. How did you first develop this enduring passion? Or put differently, did you fall in love with oceans? And if so, when?
Yes, I definitely love the ocean. And if I had to trace it back, you know, it'd have to be Jacques Cousteau. I mean, because I grew up in a small town watching television, and that was really my portal to the world. And Jacques Cousteau is probably the one who did turn me on to the oceans. And, you know, later on in life, I began diving and snorkeling, and that was a whole other experience of literally being right there and watching the animals that a lot of people see only as seafood on their plate. You know, an octopus interacting with you underwater is just this magical thing. And it's very, you know, I could never forget that. I have so many diving stories that are just, I still remember them, and they'll probably be what I remember on my deathbed, is seeing, say, huge manta rays go over me. And yeah, what could be better, really?
Seriously, I love that scene. Skipping ahead from your childhood, and I appreciate you indulging me in those early questions, to your professional life. In the 2016 book Exposed, you contend we can now judge how, quote, a study on plastic pollution published in 1973 seems ancient, end quote, when called the, quote, harm chiefly aesthetic, end quote. What led you to read Captain Charles Moore's writings on the Great Pacific Garbage Patch and make this argument about plastics as more than aesthetic?
So my earlier work on environmental justice and environmental health in bodily nature, science, environment, and the material self focused on chemicals and their invisible harms. And it takes on this question of how to dramatize the way in which usually imperceptible but dangerous substances travel through our bodies, just, you know, probably every moment. And particular sites in these patterns of racial violence, class violence, and other vectors. So when I read this piece about plastics, you know, just being, oh, they just look a little bad in the ocean floating around all this plastic pollution, I was shocked by that. And this idea, and this gets to a lot of my thinking, actually, because this assumption that objects in the world that are humanly made and produced with these xenobiotic chemicals, which just means foreign to nature, that they're just going to do what capitalism says they're going to do. So if you buy something, you know, you buy something like, say, my couch I'm sitting on, and it's supposed to just be a couch. But who knows what chemicals it's releasing and whether there's any data on it or, you know, how to trace these things. So I'm really interested in the way in which material objects have a kind of agency that can be very harmful, and also the way in which capitalism does not want us to think about that. Like, so we're in a whole way of thinking in which we assume everything in the world does what we want it to be doing. I mean, it's a great delusion that, you know, classic ideology of capitalism, I think. Yeah.
I love that explanation. This, your answer there brings to this dynamic understanding of plastics, which resonates with the term you have coined, which has had active uptake across many disciplines around the world, transcorporeality. Can you define that generative term for our listeners and explain why this term is relevant to thinking through plastics, maybe riffing off your recent work about COVID?
Yeah, so this is a complicated one. Mainly with transcorporeality, I want people to start, and this comes out of environmental health and environmental justice movements and the work I did on both of those. If we begin with our own bodies as this site that's always already immersed in these kind of flows of toxins, substances, even the weather, all kinds of things, the climate, then it makes it so that you can't just merely externalize environmentalism as a kind of optional thing. Like, hey, I guess I'll be an environmentalist, or nah, I don't really, not interested in that. It's like, you're all, where our bodies are already part of this environmental world. We can't just say, okay, we're just not interested in it. I think that's completely delusional. So that's part of it. And then let me see here. The recent work about COVID, that, you know, it's funny because during the lockdown, everything felt bizarre and strange and profoundly weird. And yet it didn't seem as weird to me because I'd been doing all of this work about multiple chemical sensitivity and just transcorporeality more generally, in which there's so much uncertainty, say drawing off of Ulrich Beck's risk culture idea, that to survive in this chemical world that humans have created, you need scientific disclosures about basic elements of your safety. And of course, with early COVID, we didn't have those. We didn't have any, so we didn't know, like, if I go out and get my mail, does touching the mail, is that going to kill me? I don't know. But I think that recognition is something that we should actually take throughout the Anthropocene, because that is the world that we have created, or capitalism has created, or colonialist, settler colonialist, extractivist, racial capitalism has created, as you know, depending on how specific you want to get and which frames to invoke and put together. That is the reality. So it's when we think we're safe, that's delusional. So so COVID was just weirdly like had already happened for me in a way with my thinking about what it is to be human in this Anthropocene environment that we've radically altered.
I completely agree. In your book Exposed, you coined another keyword that has been pivotal, at least to my work, but I also know to many others, carbon-heavy masculinity, or quote, hegemonic masculinity of impenetrable aggressive consumption, end quote. Why is it vital to address masculinity in relation to the production and impact of plastic pollution and or climate chaos? What do we miss by doing environmental studies without engaging gender and sexuality as so many do?
Yeah, well, I do think that masculinity and conventional sense of white masculinity especially is part of the problem here. And I think it does get back to the kind of opposite of transcorporeality. So if you imagine, and a bit easier, obviously, for white men to imagine this, that they are enclosed and safe within themselves, and that then they have the agency to act upon an external world, external bodies, external environments that will not then rebound and affect them. I mean, that's an extremely privileged position to imagine yourself in. And I think most women or people presenting as women already, or people identifying as women, however you want to see that, there's a long spectrum in which, I mean, obviously, gender violence, rape, et cetera, is all about somebody's being penetrated, other bodies being the penetrators. And of course, queer cultures and pro-sex feminism shift this around in all kinds of productive, fabulous, wonderful ways that are playful and sexual and erotic and all of this. And that is fantastic. I don't want to stick with, like, I'm not someone who wants to reiterate gender dualisms, even though, so I have a tricky position here. On the one hand, I'm a gender minimizing feminist. I don't want to reiterate, entrench gender dualisms. On the other hand, you can see these, I mean, almost like ridiculously cartoonish versions of white masculinity still in play. I mean, especially now, the people who were the anti-vaxxers, anti-maskers, and that one comes up a lot. So carbon heavy masculinity, what I was talking about there was the example was the rolling coal movement, where mainly white men get in these giant vehicles and try to spurt out this black coal on women in bikinis, nonetheless. Like, you couldn't get more cartoonish about gender than these scenes. But there are a bunch of videos about that. And again, I think it's just this idea that this subjectivity of dominating and having agency upon a world that's not going to come back to you, which is the feminist version of not the feminist version of this, but the feminist counterpoint would be what I call an insurgent vulnerability, not a vulnerability of a victim, but a vulnerability that's realized, number one, realized, because we all are vulnerable, obviously we are, whether we like it or not, but then also staged in terms of an activist artwork or an activist performance of insurgent vulnerability. So there's a power in taking that on and inhabiting it against the idea that our goal should just be to be these like you know, white male subjects that are impenetrable and superior to everything and not concerned about the environment. So yeah, I hope that was enough for that one.
Oh, that's a rich, that was a very rich answer. And I might not even have anything left for the next one. I was wondering if we took it down a bit just to the classroom, if you could share one way you trouble this articulation or linkage between this hegemonic racialized white masculinity and carbon. Are there particular examples or moments that you have found with a student that has been generative for you?
Yeah, I mean, I think that the Rolling Coal Movement videos, you can't get enough of those because, boy, there's a lot to talk about there. It's funny, though, because at U of O, a lot of the students are already so so cognizant of issues of gender and race and settler colonialism and other things that sometimes my approach in the classroom is to try to trouble any kind of easy answers, you know, because you don't want white women, especially white women, thinking it, what Val Plum would call that we're the angel in the house, right? Like, oh, so yeah, ecofeminism supposedly means that, you know, the ways in which women have been treated, the ways that nature have been treated are similar. So then the women are innocent of all this harm, which is absolutely ridiculous because all you have to do is think about consumerism and travel and the size of your house or something. All of those are related to class. And so, you know, clearly economics has a bigger impact on your carbon footprint or any other, you know, the creation of chemicals or production of chemicals or anything else you want to look at, extinction. Clearly, you could say that people who are the most privileged economically are more responsible for extinction, for climate change, et cetera. So that often doesn't break down. I mean, women, you know, tend to be not as economically privileged as men overall, but still that's not really where the real disparities are. It's, you know, in terms of wealthier countries, in terms of race. And yeah, so yes. So I want the gender element to be there. And I think it's really important. And especially, I do think there's a kind of ideological stance and sense of being and subjectivity that plays out that's extremely gendered. And yet that doesn't mean that especially white women are free from responsibility for racism, obviously, and all kinds of environmental problems.
Mm-hmm. Completely agree. Much of the discourse in the U.S. about plastics has focused on marine life. Would you explain how marine science studies and the blue humanities, or what you more recently have called a violet-black ecology, overlap and differ?
Yeah, you know, I was a graduate student in English at a time when you really were never supposed to speak about nature. So there's all of that. And so I was doing work in a kind of cultural studies or theoretically informed environmental thought, but I've never really known how to classify what I do. And so the term environmental humanities to me feels very recent. Even though it's supposedly new, it feels like a recent term for something a lot of people were already doing. And yet I also resist that term because to invoke the humanities is to invoke this divide between nature and culture that, you know, divides our campuses, divides how we think. And I think that environmentalism itself has to be transdisciplinary and has to look at the science as well as the sorts of social inequities and other ideological formations and the arts and literature. I think all of it has to be mixed together. And I know that's a tall order. So I guess that for what we're calling the blue humanities, I would at least make that into the blue post-humanities. So if we're looking at an aquatic or ocean-oriented humanities, it should be the post-humanities. And I would say that I've always argued that environmental studies, even if it's happening primarily in the humanities, has to engage with the science. I don't think it should just be about like, oh, here's, you know, another representation of birds. or like, it can't just be, because if we give up that, if we act within the terms of that divide, then the so-called humanities, I mean, no wonder people disparage it as useless or as not having an impact on the world. And so we need to be engaging with the science, but then we also need to do a kind of cultural studies approach where we think about the intervention of our work and what we want the work to achieve. And so I think that the so-called environmental humanities can be a little belletristic, right? Like, oh, let's read another lovely poem that has nothing to do with the world. I mean, that's what I'm trying to counter through science studies, but also through cultural studies. So I'd go for a marine blue post-humanities or something. Still, see, I don't have the words yet. I don't know what I do.
I love it. I think we probably, when we did hear about nature in graduate school and studying environmental studies, learned it through a land-centric perspective, right?
Yes.
The colonialists came to the U.S., the national parks were created, there was preservation and conservation, and so on. And so what has been the biggest challenge in studying, teaching, or publishing on marine life compared to more land-centric narratives or models of ecological thought? Have you faced or witnessed conceptual, cultural, or linguistic barriers?
Yes, absolutely. So first off, I'm a feminist theorist and feminist cultural studies person. And so I do want, and animal studies, post-humanist, you throw a lot of things in there, but a lot of that work, because it's based on the land, is much more, has to do with multi-species relations that are much more immediate. So, you know, like Donna Haraway is talking about dogs as companion species. Well, your companion species is literally right next to you most of the time. There's that. Something like Robin Wall Kimmerer from a whole different indigenous tradition talking about plants and this very active touching and working with and helping the plants to thrive as a relational reciprocity, which is a really beautiful idea. And then a lot of animal studies work looks at the animals that are either most like humans or the most intelligent or the ones that we're most, you know, close to, again, like companion species. And so one of the things that was my challenge in writing about the deep sea creatures was, how do you foster care and concern? How can we care about and be concerned with, say, a jellyfish or a deep sea creature or something else that doesn't even really seem like a life form? Like, what is that thing? It's 90% water. Why do we care about that? We have no interactions with it. They're not part of our lives. So how do we care for them? What would it mean to care for them? So that's been at the forefront. And then thinking through mediation and scale, because if we have an image of a deep sea creature that's on our screen, say if we're on social media or just, I don't know, where else, wherever we are, these images circulating, then this sense of speculation about the scale, like, we're not connected to it. And yet at some scale we are in the Anthropocene, because we're already implicated in the destruction of their habitat and maybe in their extinction. And what does that all look like? But then my main limitation, which I put as a kind of horizon to the book, is that even though I'm talking about these realms of the deep seas, which don't really belong to any particular group, one of my limitations as a scholar, obviously, since the ocean is this global topic, is I don't know that many languages. Like, I couldn't research this, and it would be impossible too for me to write in such a way that I was looking at, say, traditional ecological knowledges of the deep seas, and so there's so much out there that I hope other people will do more and more of this work, because I cannot do it. I'm not in a position to do that work. So instead I try to just critique and work with the kind of big science as it has dealt with these deep sea creatures, but then also, I guess, to kind of defend what I'm doing, even as I think it's really important that these other, often marginalized traditions are rising up in importance and esteem, and which I think is fantastic. I still think that in terms of critique, the kind of dominant popular culture, because the dominant popular culture reaches a lot of people, and because it's part and parcel of the whole like extractive capitalist industrial like taking of things from the sea, that's still important to focus on those things from a level of critique. So yeah.
Wonderfully rich answer. When it comes to plastics taking us to the surface of marine life, marine life has taken the center stage of early advocacy. A turtle with a plastic straw, a dead whale washing ashore. Back in the 80s, it was dolphins and tuna nets. And I know your research involves aesthetic depictions of deep sea creatures as both paradoxically a commodification and an expression of care. Can you say a little bit more about what might be entailed in this, as you were just addressing, care for creatures of the deep sea, and what modes of care have been moving you of late?
So the project began, and it's weird. This has taken me a million years to write this book, unfortunately. But the project began with looking at the census of marine life images that they had been circulating in coffee table books and also in websites. And now I'm back. Finally, I'm at the point where I can write that chapter, finish it, and maybe get this done. But one of the things that impressed me there was that even though the Census of Marine Life was this huge global scientific effort, that they put a lot of emphasis on these very aestheticized images of the sea creatures. And I can see that as in and of itself a mode of care, in that the sort of photographic captures of these creatures are not the way that you would see them in, say, a textbook. They're very much like Claire Nuvian's work called The Deep, which is this big, gorgeous coffee table book with these giant portraits of deep sea creatures. Even creatures without a face are presented as if they are portraits. And the work and the artistry that she took to make them that appealing and to foster this sense of connection, because we're humans are going to respond as if this were a face there. Like I think that was a lot of care that was meant to then provoke care. And then in a way, like crafting the element of crafting this and making the creatures look like they are a species worthy of care. But then of course the viewer has to take the next step and engage in a kind of speculation about like, well, what are the lives of these creatures like? Like, what would it be like to be this creature, this Dumbo octopus or some other creature? Like, what are they living? And at that moment in those speculations, it's a kind of concern and care that I hope it's not just a kind of commodification or consumption, like, oh, they're so pretty, oh, it makes me feel so good. And actually there are jellyfish videos that you can buy for relaxation. So obviously there's a whole genre of using these creatures just for our own kind of aesthetic enjoyment or relaxation or whatever, in the way that the entire world is supposed to be there for all of us to just take from constantly and use however we'd like. But I'm hoping that there's still the possibility of people thinking about ethical and political issues concerning those animals. And yeah, so And that's really the only, because so little is known about most of the deep sea creatures. What's funny to me is that the scientists often express too, this kind of like awe and wonder, and there's not a lot else to put out there in the public. Jory Graham has a great poem about deep sea trawling that's fantastic, where she's imagining them. But, and I write about that in the book, but, yeah, I feel like the care and concern put into the stylizations, which doesn't sound like real care and concern in a way. It's like the closest that we can have in this kind of mediated environment.
Yeah, creating that sense of wonder or engagement, at least.
Yes.
So often popular academic terms like Anthropocene and object-oriented ontologies are used by some to deflect attention away from care for identity-based concerns about justice and reify cis white male philosophers as the key voices, the sole voices of theory and science. You don't do this. So I'm wondering if you could share, how can marine science studies and or post-humanist blue ecologies not serve as a white flight from racial and colonial accountability, but guide us towards a more just world for all?
Yeah, I mean, I think the most vivid example of this would just be this huge scale of industrialized fishing and the kind of grotesque, wasteful, destructive practices. Now, that might sound like I'm not answering the question, but the issue is that these huge industrialized fishing ships go out and they trawl or catch or kill just huge expanses of areas, and they destroy the ecosystems, and then they end up throwing away as bycatch something between like 70 to 90% or even more of the creatures that they have killed, not to mention the whole ecosystems that they have disrupted. And so then when that happens, all of the local communities, including indigenous communities that rely upon various creatures from the sea for their food and sustenance, but then also it could be part of their culture, part of their kinship networks, part of various cultural practices. So part of their cosmology, their imaginary, all sorts of things. So those cultures, whether they're indigenous or other sorts of local cultures, are deprived of food and their cultures taken away from them to some extent by industrialized fishing. So, I mean, I think that that's really important to keep in mind, because it's, you know, people think, well, it's that's sort of an issue, like being against industrialized overfishing wouldn't be a racial issue or issue of colonialism or indigenous, but it really, really is. I mean, even the fact that if the people who have to go out now to try to fish from local communities have to keep going out into deeper and deeper and more dangerous and more treacherous waters because their own fishing stocks have been completely depleted. So there's that. And of course, in Oregon, we're very aware of the orcas who are starving and the low salmon populations and how the salmon has affected various tribal areas. My colleague, Kari Norgaard, wrote a book called Salmon and Acorns Feed Our People about, I think, the Karuk tribes and how they've lost their food source and how that's had health impacts and also cultural impacts. So yeah, I mean, I think you pull, you know, you look at one thing and you pull that thread, and it almost always has some kind of racial or, you know, colonial or other issue happening.
Completely agree. Relatedly, you identify with new materialism, but are clear that materiality matters. You recently wrote, quote, "We can't escape the material world through metaphor. We can't travel through tropes. Social and environmental visions and aesthetic representations can, of course, inspire change through their visions of what is possible. But the danger is that we are all so well trained to compartmentalize these lights of fancy, indulging them even as we routinely live in profoundly destructive ways, end quote. That's amazing prose. As someone who also believes figures of speech and expression deeply matter, while matter beyond does as well, can you say more about what or who motivated you to write these poetic lines?
So I talked a little bit about this before with the pandemic. To connect this back to the whole idea of, you know, why I object to the environmental humanities and the emphasis on the humanities, this sense that, you know, if you create this really inspiring poem about something and everybody feels inspired in that moment, like, and then what is the question? And then what? So there's that. But what I was citing is, and I apologize, I don't have this handy, but the portal essay, the famous portal essay. Do you remember the name of that?
You mean Arundhati Roy's The Pandemic is a Portal?
Okay. Yes. So I thought that was a beautiful and moving essay, but it also really made it seem like we could just enter through a portal. Like part of it is like, oh, we're going to walk through this door and then racism is going to disappear and inequality is going to disappear. Like, because we're all having this little moment brought on by COVID where suddenly we can imagine another world and then it will happen. Well, you know, people, I mean, look at racial justice movements, look at feminist movements, look at, like, you can look at all these movements, look at queer movements right now, and then look at the backlash. I mean, the horrific backlash and this sense of how do you get traction with movements when there's so much backlash? And also in terms of, you know, what we do in the humanities, this kind of cultural studies model, I think, is a good one, in which it's always, Stuart Hall talked about ideology and the dog catchers, right? Like we you kind of do this thing to push back against this ideological formation, and then the next day the dog catchers go out and round up all of those people who are not adhering to the ideology or the hegemony, and that it's just this perpetual struggle, really. And so I'm suspicious of any discourse this sounds weird, but I'm going to say that I'm suspicious of any inspiring discourses, in a way, like the kind of vision, like, oh, we're just going to envision it and then we feel inspired. Okay, that's the easy part, in a way, like, and then what? And then what do you do? And so, yeah, I'm suspicious of hope. I think hope is delusional. I think hope and despair are two sides of the same coin. I'm suspicious of it because we always say, oh, well, we have to be hopeful. We have to teach our students to hope. And I think, well, not really. Like what if people do things? Like, what if people figure, like, you learn things and then you do things, and then you learn more, and then you do more, like that kind of engagement. That's very, it doesn't sound as lovely, or as, you know, it's not the end of a rom-com or something. I don't know. It's more quotidian, but I think that's, you know, the whole Buddhist thing, before enlightenment, chop wood, carry water, after enlightenment, chop wood, carry water. So yeah,
it might be onto something.
No escape hatch for me. I don't believe in escape hatches.
You have been a critical mentor and inspiration for many to believe environmental studies can become more inclusive, and one of your contributions has been to write the foreword for a worthwhile collection co-edited by Sarah Jaquette Ray and Jay Sabara, Disability in the Environmental Humanities. What signs of eco-ableism in the environmental humanities still trouble you today?
So that's a great question. And I wish I had more time to think about it. I mean, you know, living in Oregon, obviously the kind of adventure culture and the things that Sarah Jacquette Ray critiques in her own book, those are still very, very prevalent. I think I'm going to critique ASLE a little bit here. So a lot of years back, the organization ASLE, which does the study of environmental literature, planned a conference in Idaho. And it's Idaho had these great environmental humanities scholars. They're fantastic. The venue is gorgeous, beautiful. But I think one of the things that wasn't thought about carefully enough was this access to nature, not only like as a disability issue in this case, but more in terms of for racially marked and then gender nonconforming or queer people, like what does it mean to drive through and into Idaho? Like these are still dangerous areas. This country is all mapped by areas in which certain peoples are not welcome. And I don't think that's gotten any better. I think it's gotten worse actually with the Trump era. And so the issue of accessibility, I think, has to be a kind of, you know, intersectional in the old sense of the word, of the, all of the different categories intersecting in terms of race and gender and queer life. And not only disability there. I think in terms of disability studies, my main contribution there was thinking through more indoor places as not accessible for people with environmental illness or multiple chemical sensitivity, and thinking of accessibility in terms of chemical and other kinds of hazardous indoor environments.
Yeah, part of why I wanted to bring up disability is because on this podcast, we've discussed plastic bans and the need to move away from fossil fuels, but also care for disability access. Do you believe we can and should divest completely from fossil fuels? And how does that position relate to your thoughts on accessibility?
Yes, I think we absolutely should divest from fossil fuels. And I also think we should minimize our plastic use. I mean, however we can minimize plastic use, let's do it. Except, of course, if there are particular people who need a particular plastic item, especially people with disabilities, then that should always be available and should be there. And I don't see the access to plastic being ever wiped out, because of course you can't even imagine the medical system without plastic, for example, or the food system entirely. Like hopefully we'll something will happen and the plastics will be created to be compostable or something. There's some of that now, but not in all areas, right? So I don't see the two things really being in conflict. I mean, I think one of the things that really depresses me is when the media circulates these things as if they're binary, like it's either we're going to get rid of all plastics forever tomorrow to save the environment and all the sea creatures, or if that happens, disabled people will not be able to have straws who need straws, or because this group of people needs straws, then we shouldn't do anything about plastic pollution. I mean, what percentage of plastic pollution would straws of people who actually need straws be in this world? I mean, what minute percentage could that be? I mean, it's more the routine, you know, giving every single person a straw, whether they want it or not. I mean, that's so... I mean, I think a lot of these issues circulate in a way that just is trying to let, I think the reaction is just lets people off the hook. Like, oh, those environmentalists, they care about plastic, but that means they don't care about people with disabilities. So if they don't care about people with disabilities, then we should not care about environmental. It's like, wow, life is more complicated than that. And you can make progress on a lot of fronts without falling into this trap, this either or dualism, people with disabilities versus, I mean, and then now, like on the West Coast, there's such a problem with the unhoused. There's, you know, we desperately need housing. And of course, you know, if you're, of course, many people are in positions, including the unhoused, where plastics are really vital for them for all kinds of reasons. So I think there are a lot of different groups of people that would require something like plastic, if not plastic itself. So I guess I don't see a conflict there really. I mean, I think you go for the low hanging fruit, like let's just get rid of plastics that really are unnecessary first. And that would be a lot.
In closing, I'm wondering if you could share a teaser for your current book project, which we've been alluding to, Deep Blue Ecology, Science, Aesthetics, and the Creatures of the Abyss. Perhaps maybe leaving us with a reflection of a deep sea creature as intrinsically wonderful in ways that exceed humans, or as a resource for environmental kinship and empathy between the shared vulnerability of humans and non-humans.
So I think I will just say that the aesthetic may seem as billowy and insubstantial as a jellyfish, but it has the power to disrupt science, critique anthropocentric modes of knowledge, and expand the terrain of environmental concern. For some creatures, such as those from the deep sea, the aesthetic captures are the only way to provoke care.
Fabulous. I look forward to reading that book. Thank you, Stacy, for talking with us today.
Thank you. And I look forward to reading your book.